All right, thank you. This talk is largely based on a recent paper that I did with Massimo Bianchi, Daniel Friedman, and Christoph Pilch, and some of the earlier details were done in a paper by me and Dan. So, I'll give an overview of what I'm going to talk about. Now, by now, is there a way to keep these transparencies from following geodesics? All right.
I'm looking. You should have talked to me.
Okay. So, by now, examples of the holographic correspondence with conformal symmetry, that is the ADS-CFT correspondence, are well understood, and there's a program that was developed for working out correlation functions 2, 3, and even 4-point functions were computed. Now, it's naturally of interest to break conformal symmetry and study some theories where there's a non-trivial renormalization group flow in the field theory, and in fact, one of the beautiful things about the correspondence is that the gravity side will then realize the RG flow as a structure in space-time itself. So there have been many examples constructed of different such backgrounds without conformal symmetry, including the sort that we're going to talk about today, which are constructed using five-dimensional maximally supersymmetric gauged supergravity, which I'll review, which then implies the existence of 10-dimensional solutions through the magic of consistent truncation. And in the five-dimensional gauge supergravity setup, the relevant perturbations that you turned on in order to break the conformal symmetry appear as non-trivial profiles of various scalar fields that evolve in the bulk. So in order to actually calculate correlation functions for field theory operators, as we probably know, the program is you have to solve equations, fluctuation equations in the background for the bulk fields that are dual to the operators you're interested in. Now, in the non-conformal case, only 2-point functions have been worked out so far because it's a more involved process, but 2-point functions are still interesting because they tell you about the spectra of the operators in the field theory. Now, previously, the only examples that have been worked out, these are bulk modes, are free uncoupled scalars, which are pretty easy to compute, the transverse traceless graviton, which can be cast in the form of an uncoupled scalar, and also an active scalar was looked at. By active, I mean fluctuations of one of the scalars that is actually varying in the background. Now, what we're going to consider today is fluctuation equations for all sorts of different modes of various spins making up entire supermultiplets in the bulk. So we'll be looking at vectors, various Fermi fields, and other scalars. And we'll find solutions for all of these, all of which have a hypergeometric form. And in particular, is this visible down here at the bottom? Not really, maybe. Not to the back. The two examples that we're going to look at, one of them is an n equals 1 flow that was constructed by Giardello, Petrini, Parati, and Zaffaroni, which we'll call the GPPZ flow. We'll look at all of the fields that are singlet under the preserved R symmetry. We'll find the solutions for them and discrete spectra. I will also look a little more briefly at a Coulomb branch flow, which preserves more supersymmetry and has a continuous spectrum above a mass gap. However, while we're doing this, what we're going to be most interested in is seeing the structure of how holography realizes the breaking of conformal invariance and superconformal invariance. Now, the gravity multiplet in the bulk is dual to the supercurrent multiplet in the field theory. I'll elaborate more on that later. And one of the consequences of what we'll show is we'll be able to show that the so-called physical modes of the gravity multiplet, the graviton, gravitino, and the gravifoton, can all be cast in terms of a single free auxiliary scalar, which we call F, and the solutions are much easier to find in that point of view. But further, we're going to find that the field theory statement that the trace of the stress tensor fails to vanish, which means that conformal invariance is broken, translates to something very specific in the bulk theory, which is that the trace of the graviton will mix with another field, namely with the fluctuation of the active scalar. And in fact, we'll be able to generalize this the trace of the stress tensor has various superpartners, and in fact, this non-conservation is expressed in a superfield language in field theory here, where the superspace divergence of the supercurrent, this is the supercurrent here, is non-zero, but it's proportional to this anomaly multiplet, A, which contains the trace of the stress tensor and a few other fields. And in fact, this can be mapped precisely to a bulk statement, which is that the entire gravity multiplet mixes with the active multiplet modes. This is a generalization of this statement here. In fact, we'll find that the active multiplet is the exact, the modes of the active multiplet constitute the bulk fields that are dual to this anomaly multiplet here. So we'll have a nice picture relating the anomaly multiplet and the active multiplet. And we're going to find, when we set out to study the two different flows that we'll examine, the N equals 1 flow and the Coulomb bench flow, we were mostly interested in the fact that one was an explicit breaking of conformal symmetry and the other a spontaneous breaking. But actually, the differences that we'll find in the bulk are not related to that difference. We'll find instead that the salient difference between them has to do with whether our symmetry associated to the gravifoton is broken or unbroken. And that will correlate with the type of active multiplet that we study. And finally, the last thing I want to mention in the overview is that in the process, we'll get to solve some interesting coupled systems in five-dimensional gravity. One of them is the coupled gravitino and spin one-half sector. This is sort of the super partner of the fact that the graviton trace will mix with the active scalar. And we'll find that four-dimensional chirality operators or chirality projectors naturally arise because of supersymmetry, even though that the bulk, of course, is only five-dimensional to start out with. We'll also look at the scalar sector. The scalars fill out a coset of G22 mod SU2 cross SU2, which I'll talk about briefly. We're able to find the potential for this. And finally, we'll talk about the vector sector and how whether or not a given vector is massive or massless is associated with the multiplet structure. And in fact, we'll see how non-trivial kinetic terms for the massless vector fields can imitate the vector mass that arises in the massive case and give a universal effective vector mass for all of these vector particles. Questions before I move on?
I guess just a minor one. I mean, so you're talking about mixing here of the perturbations, but if you keep to the conformally invariant case,
sure,
then the modes, I suppose these are the modes that are not coupled initially.
Right, so in,
coupling, right?
In the conformally invariant case, what you'll find is that of, say, these two modes, they will not mix anymore. This mode will just be free, and this mode can be gauged away. Because there are more diffeomorphisms with which to work.
Not more diffeomorphisms.
Well, maybe there are more isometries of the boundary, maybe. It's better to say. One doesn't have the full anti-de Sitter space set of isometries, but only a set of isometries corresponding to four-dimensional Minkowski space. Any more questions? Okay. Well, let me review a little bit. Oh, there goes that quarter. I have money of my own. Just a postdoc, though, so I don't have a nickel. Okay, so let me briefly review five-dimensional gauge supergravity and its relation to field theory. So type 2B supergravity in 10 dimensions contains these massless fields. Did I write them all, or did I just write the bosonic ones? I wrote them all. Some p-form gauge fields, a complex scalar, some fermions, graviton. Now, the five-dimensional gauge supergravity, although it was originally constructed on its own, is now at least largely thought to be, it's almost certain to be, the lowest Kaluza-Klein harmonics of type 2b reduced on ADS5 cross S5. And as we know, this particular setup is dual to N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory, the original ADS-CFT correspondence. So I wrote here the modes of five-dimensional gauge supergravity. Here are the symmetries of the theory. One has an isometry of ADS5, which is SO4, 2, which, as we know, is the conformal symmetry of the CFT. Furthermore, one has an SO6 gauge group in gauge supergravity, which can be thought of as coming from the isometries of the S5, which you compactified on, and that corresponds to the R symmetry in the field theory. The gauge fields that gauge this group are these 15 A mu here. Furthermore, you have 42 scalar fields, some of which will be important to us. They parameterize the somewhat daunting coset E66 mod USP8. E6 can be thought of as the uduality group in five dimensions, and USP8, this is its maximally non-compact version, and USP8 is the maximal compact subgroup. In gauge supergravity, you also get a potential for 40 of these fields. And here I've made a little table of the different scalar fields and how the 42 of them break up into representations of the gauge group SO6. So you have a 20 prime. These scalars, if you lift back to 10 dimensions, are modes coming from the metric and the 4 form. They're dual to this trace x squared operators in field theory. And then there's a complex 10 and a complex singlet. Complex 10 lifts to the various 2 form potentials. So when one turns on one of these, one is turning on 3-form flux in the 10-dimensional version. These correspond to masses for the various Fermi fields. And then this complex singlet can be thought of as the reduction of the dilaton, at least to leading order, and it's dual to the Lagrangian of the n equals 4 theory. So that is the theory we'll be using, and then the strategy for constructing backgrounds that correspond to field theories with an RG flow is to write a domain wall background where the metric has this form. We're preserving here four-dimensional Poincaré invariants explicitly. There's an overall scale factor which depends on the fifth dimension, and then we also can turn on some of these scalars, but we only let them vary in the fifth dimension because we want to preserve that four-dimensional symmetry. Furthermore, in the limit that you approach the boundary, you want to recover five-dimensional ADS. This is just a statement that when you go into the ultraviolet, you're recovering n equals 4 super Yang mils. So these are perturbations of that theory. So the scalars have to go to 0 in that limit. Now, by turning on this something non-trivial for the scalars, we're breaking translation invariance in the R coordinate of the gravity theory, which is dual to scale transformations in the field theory. So we're explicitly breaking scale invariance in the field theory dual by doing that. And generically, we're also going to break some of the R symmetry, the SO6 R symmetry, because these fields that we turned on will have non-trivial gauge quantum numbers. Furthermore, there are two different options for what kind of background you get, depending on the scaling of the scalar field profiles that you turned on near the boundary. Ones that scale like this correspond to a dual field theory operator that's actually changing the dynamics of the theory. It perturbs the Lagrangian, makes into something new, so that explicitly breaks conformal invariance. While these solutions, which have a softer falloff, are dual only to changing the vacuum of the field theory. So you're spontaneously breaking conformal invariance. And as I said, we're going to look at one example of each of these. And I also just wanted to comment on singularities, though I won't be talking about them in any detail. The five-dimensional descriptions do generically have a singularity where the scale factor vanishes somewhere in the infrared. This means that the infrared physics is basically invisible in a five-dimensional point of view, and that can only be seen in the 10 dimensions. The lift to 10 dimensions will often, though not always, mitigate the singularity to a point where it can be resolved by some brains in the background, for example. So to see infrared physics, one really needs to look at the 10-dimensional point of view, but for what we're trying to calculate, which is correlation functions and also seeing the structures of the breaking of conformal symmetry, superconformal symmetry, we'll only need to look at the behavior near the UV. So besides preserving four-dimensional Poincaré invariants in our background and maybe some R symmetry, we'd also like to have theories that preserve some supersymmetry. Now at the top here, I've written out the explicit variations of the Fermi fields in the gauge supergravity theory. They're somewhat complicated, but in fact, in the simple cases, one can solve them using relatively straightforward equations. They reduce to things that are much simpler. The general scheme is that in the Gravitino equation, there appears this tensor and scalar space, which is a function of the various scalar fields, and one can find the eigenvalues of that tensor, which come in pairs, and then construct the complex eigenvector associated to those two pairs. And in that case, this equation can be solved merely by requiring two things. One is that the scale factor, so the metric, is related to this particular function of the scalar fields. So this ties together the curvature of space and the way the scalars are evolving as you move in the fifth dimension. And then you also have to put a constraint on the supersymmetry parameter. It has to be written in this way in terms of what you can think of as a four-dimensional spinner with four-dimensional chirality here. And then once you've solved the first equation, the second equation, which looks even more scary, will reduce to something that's much easier to solve, that just tells you about the evolution of the scalar fields as you move in the r coordinate and relates them back to themselves. So once you have a solution for these first order equations, as is generically the case in first order supersymmetry systems, the solutions to the first order equations always solve the second order equations of motion. And that's due to the fact that the potential that the scalars have in the Lagrangian can be expressed in terms of the eigenvalues of this W tensor here in this fashion. There are also some superconformal supersymmetries which are broken in all of our backgrounds along with conformal invariants. I don't really need to talk about them. Questions at this point? So let me mention the first of the two backgrounds that I'm going to discuss. This is the one that was proposed as a dual description for n equals 1 super Yang-Mills. It's a little lacking in that respect, we have since found, though it's still an interesting flow. Was formulated by these guys. It involves turning on a single scalar m, which is in the complex 10 that we talked about before. This corresponds to turning on a mass for three of the four chiral superfields of the n equals 4 theory, viewed in an n equals 1 point of view. And it breaks the R symmetry from the original SU4 all the way down to SO3. This preserved SO3 will be an important group for us later. So this is the superpotential explicitly, and this is the solution. One can solve it as a function of the R coordinate. Though when we actually solve the differential equations later on, we're going to find this U variable to be much more convenient. It's not important that you know what it is, just that it has a good definition. GPPZ also talked about a family of solutions where not only M, but sigma was also turned on. This is another element of the 10, but it's a singlet of SU3. We're not going to talk of, no, I don't think I'm going to say anything about these generic families. So anyway, these backgrounds have the usual strong coupling problem that you have in supergravity duals to Yang-Mills theories, which is that the mass scale of the glue balls, which is what you're interested in, is in the same order of the mass scales of all the other things that you want to integrate out to get them out of the way, and there's not much you can do about it. But as I said, understanding the infrared physics is not really our goal here. And I just wanted to mention that actually the metric and the complex scalar in this solution have been lifted to 10 dimensions by Pilch and Warner, where they found a ring of PQ5 brains. So they have an interesting structure, which I don't think is fully understood, though it has some interpretation in terms of the Polchinski-Strassler solution. But I don't want to talk about that in detail. Questions? Okay. So we'll warm up solving the fluctuation equations for the various fields by talking about the gravity multiplet, which is dual in field theory to the supercurrent multiplet. Now this field theory multiplet consists of the stress tensor, the supersymmetry current, and also a U1R current. This is the superfield formulation of it. And this couples in the bulk to an n equals 2 supergravity multiplet, which has a graviton, a gravitino, and a gravifoton. And what we're interested in solving first are what we're going to call the so-called physical modes of these three guys. By that we mean restrict the indices to take values only in the first four dimensions, not in the fifth. We're also going to require that these fields are transverse and traceless, or gamma traceless, in the case of the gravitino. This will allow us to drop a lot of the other terms, which will come back to haunt us later. And then, when one does this, looking at the graviton first, one can write out Einstein's equations linearized to first order. One finds the Ricci tensor is equal to some modified stress tensor here. And it's well known that for a generic RG flow background, this reduces to just the equation of motion for a free scalar with no mass and no potential, which is this here, where F is just written in terms of the physical graviton mode with these extra sort of polarizations out front, which enforce that it's transverse and traceless.
Can you remind me how you know that's a consistent gauge choice?
I wouldn't call it a gauge choice. I'm merely considering some of the modes.
But how do you know they don't couple with the others?
I've checked it. I'll talk about the other modes later. The other modes of the graviton, in fact, couple to the active scalar. Mm-hmm. And those have to be are much more difficult to deal with. So I'm just starting with the ones that are free, in fact.
Okay.
So in the particular GPPZ background that I alluded to, one can solve this equation. It's a hypergeometric equation. Hypergeometric solution, and one finds a particular spectrum of poles in the dual field theory operator, which looks like this for integer n. So it's sort of nice, and I don't think at this point completely understood that this TT graviton should reduce to a scalar like that.
Excuse me, what's
yes.
The metric, let's see, you say the metric perturbation is the scalar times VIVJ?
What I'm saying is that I can solve this equation by writing the metric fluctuation in terms of a scalar field, which actually depends on the radial coordinate as well as the other four coordinates, which I Fourier transform them into momentum space. And then also, this is essentially a polarization tensor. That's all.
So V is a vector field you have to solve for?
V is a field that depends generically on the momentum, but not on the R coordinate. So it just comes out front of this equation and was dropped. So you just need to have something here that enforces the fact that this mode is transverse traceless. Basically, all it means is take the graviton, divide it into all the various modes. Some of them will be transverse and traceless. Each and every one of those TT modes obeys separately this equation. Okay?
Each component, I see.
Each of those components.
And you say that's independent of the actual form of A, so this is true for perturbations?
That's right. I mean, it depends on A only in that A is here and here.
This is what Sanam did when he did the perturbation.
A little louder, please.
But this is what Sigur Sanam did when he did the supercomputing calculation from string theory. This is how he chose the transfer gauge for the current.
So, having reduced the physical graviton mode to that sort of auxiliary free scalar, one might hope that one could do the same thing for its superpartners. And in fact, you can. And in doing so, we'll see a nice general form for the vector field. So the equations of motion in this particular background for the spin 3/2 and spin 1/2 field look like this. The gravitino just has the usual Rorita-Schwinger kinetic term plus a mass term, which is generic for gravitini in ADS backgrounds. And then the gauge field just has a usual kinetic term, but it also has a mass. And we'll talk more about the origin of that mass term later, but for now it just has this mass, which can be written in this way in terms of the second derivative of the scale factor. And one can show by using the supersymmetry transformations associated to this graviton multiplet, that in fact the solution for the graviton in terms of F can be transformed into solutions for the gravitino and for the gravifoton also in terms of F. So one should not think of this as being, it's not that all of these fluctuations are turned on at the same time and each of them is proportional to F. It's that each one fluctuating individually is proportional to this same function, which is a solution to that differential equation we had in the previous transparency. And you can see explicitly that the fact that we had to require these Vs that Gary was asking about to enforce the graviton being transverse and traceless means that this guy is transverse and gamma traceless and that this guy is transverse. So it works out just as we wanted it to. The entire multiplet, in fact, gets determined by this single auxiliary scalar. So those modes are, in a sense, the simplest to deal with. Let me discuss for a moment how universal this might be, because I was talking a moment ago about this particular background, the GPPZ flow. Will this change when I look at some other RG flow background? Well, the equation for the graviton fluctuation reducing to the auxiliary scalar is completely universal, as we just mentioned. One can certainly show that the gravitino is universal for any truncation of n equals 8 supergravity. I haven't proved it in general for any sort of generic supergravity in five dimensions, but it's certainly plausible that it's completely universal since it just involves a Rita-Schwinger term and a mass term, which is necessary in an ADS background. However, the graviphoton is not nearly so generic. One can show that given a Lagrangian for the graviphoton like this, where the kinetic term is canonical, then the only way to achieve supersymmetry with the other two modes is indeed to have this same graviphoton mass that we talked about before. However, in principle, one could have a function of the scalar fields multiplying these kinetic terms. In fact, that does happen in some cases, but the general rules of n equals 2 supergravity, which is minimal in five dimensions, tell you that for scalars and hypermultiplets, this sort of term cannot appear. And in fact, in the case at hand, the GPPZ flow, the active scalar is indeed in a hypermultiplet. So that's why this term stayed canonical. One can therefore make the statement that as long as the scalar, the active scalar, is in a hypermultiplet, then in order for supersymmetry to be achieved, the graviphoton has to have this mass term. If it has a mass, it means that the associated R symmetry has to be spontaneously broken, or it has to be broken, I should say, so that U1R is in fact broken whenever you have an active scalar and a hypermultiplet. We'll come back to this a little later. In the Coulomb branch flow, we'll actually have a scalar, an active scalar that's not in a hypermultiplet, and we'll find that despite the fact that we have no mass term, and instead we have non-trivial gauge kinetic terms like this, that the equations for the graviphoton are going to be secretly equivalent.
By the way, did you assume that the trace of h hat was zero?
Yes.
But then v has to be null.
Yes.
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 So this onslaught only works when v is null.
Yes. I mean, what I've done is I've taken the graviton, which has all sorts of different modes. Here, so far I've talked about the modes which are free. They don't couple to lower spin fields. And I had to put constraints on V that it's traceless and that it's also transverse. In a moment, I'll talk about the other modes of the graviton where that is not satisfied, which are more complicated. So yeah, it's not a gauge choice or anything. It's just looking selectively at some modes and then later looking selectively at others. So before I move on to talk about the other modes, let me move over to the field theory universe for a moment. As we talked about before, when the field theory is conformally invariant, there's this supercurrent superfield whose divergence is zero. And the components of this tell you that the trace of the stress tensor, the gamma trace of the supersymmetry current, and the divergence of the R current all vanish. However, when conformal invariance is broken, this equation develops a right-hand side. This chiral superfield A can be written in terms of its components, and these components contain not only the trace of the stress tensor, but also non-zero values for this gamma trace and this divergence. So this superfield equation contains all the information about the breaking of conformal invariance and its superpartners. So the question we want to ask is, how does this sort of breaking manifest itself in the bulk? What occurs in the bulk theory once conformal invariance is broken to incorporate this structure? And what we're going to find is that the multiplet, which is dual to these operators that make up the chiral superfield A, which contain the active scalar, will mix at quadratic order with all the lower spin modes. Those are the modes we haven't talked about so far, of the graviton and its superpartners, like the trace, the gamma trace of the gravitino, and the divergence of the gravifotons. There's sort of a parallel structure between these and these, which should be evident. And this will emerge when we study the SO3 singlets of the GPP Z flow, which is what I want to turn to now.
What is SO3?
What is SO3? SO3 is the remnant of the SU4R symmetry that is preserved in this background. SO3 is almost an R symmetry. It's not really an R symmetry because it's not an R symmetry with respect to the one supercharge, the four supercharges that you actually preserve when you break it from n equals 4 down to n equals 1. But it is a remnant of the original R symmetry, which I guess is a global symmetry. So just to make life a little easier for ourselves, but still to have a hefty chunk of fields to examine, we decided to truncate to all of the SO3 singlet fields, which of course can only mix amongst themselves, and try to solve their fluctuation equations. So one can do the group theory, and what you learn is that of all of those fields in n equals 8 supergravity that I wrote down before, the 42 scalars, the 12 two forms, etc., all that survives is one gravity multiplet. We've already talked about the physical modes, and then two hypermultiplets. One which we call the active hypermultiplet because it contains fluctuations of the scalar that's turned on in the background. And the other which we call the dilaton hypermultiplet because it contains the dilaton. These in the middle are Fermi fields. These are complex scalars. And it turns out that the scalars, one can show, parametrize a subspace of the original E66 mod USP8 coset, which is G22 mod SU2 cross SU2, which is sort of an ugly thing, but by the time you resolve it, it gets sort of pretty. We'll talk about that briefly. And we solve the quadratic fluctuation equations for all these fields and find three distinct spectra, one for each multiplet. So we will begin by talking about the graviton. So here are the other modes of the graviton that we didn't already discuss. So let me write my metric like this, where H is the fluctuation of the graviton. And furthermore, let me assume that the M scalar above its background value has some fluctuating field. And one finds, I won't write out all the extremely tedious equations that come from Einstein's equations and the Klein-Gordon equation, but that the various traces of the graviton and the fluctuation of the active scalar all mix, even at the linearized level. So it's an involved coupled system. And in order to solve this, one has to fix a gauge. There are a couple of different attempts to do this. The first attempt, which was done by me and Dan Friedman, was to use an axial gauge, where you gauge away H55. Oh, by the way, I already implicitly gauged away sort of graviton fluctuations that are off diagonal between the four dimensions and the fifth dimension. So one can do this. There are some problems, though. They're not intractable problems, but they're a big pain, which is that this is not a complete gauge fix. It turns out there are still residual diffeomorphisms that preserve this gauge. And the fact that these spurious solutions exist means that all the equations of motion have to be solved not only by the actual solution, but by the gauge artifact solution as well. And as a result, the best you can do is to reduce these coupled differential equations to an ordinary differential equation of third order, which we actually did solve. But calculating correlation functions in this picture proved to be somewhat difficult and a little opaque. So it turns out that there are better gauges in which to do this. out of Tyungov, Froloff, and Thiessen suggested a gauge where you gauge away the fluctuation of the scalar entirely, but keep all of these graviton modes. An analogous one is one that we call dynamical scalar gauge, where you keep the scalar as the source of dynamics, but get rid of a certain trace of the graviton. And these are much better gauge fixes. They're complete gauge fixes, and they allow you to reduce the system to a second-order ordinary differential equation for one mode, and then a number of other equations, algebraic equations, that determine the other modes of the system. So this was done, and the solution in dynamical scalar gauge is written here. It's another hypergeometric equation. One can calculate the spectrum of poles. Now, one cute thing about this gauge freedom that you have left between these two gauges that I like, which I wrote in purple, is that using the gauge freedom shuffles back and forth the dynamic information between the graviton and the active scalar. And in fact, if you look at the solution for the scalar in the one gauge, compare it to the solution for the trace of the graviton in the other gauge, the proportionality constant, which depends on the fifth dimension, is exactly the so-called holographic beta function, which is how the scalar background, which is the coupling constant essentially, varies with the scale of the theory. And this is very suggestive of the field theory relation, where the trace of the stress tensor is proportional to the operator that was added to the Lagrangian by turning on M, and the proportionality factor here involves the regular field theory beta function, which depends on the scale. So in this case, you have an algebraic relation that determines one in terms of the other, and here you have a gauge freedom that lets you reshuffle from one to the other, back and forth.
The dynamical scalar gauge is not the Feynman gauge, right?
Not the Feynman gauge? Well, it's this. I'm not sure what the Feynman gauge is for the graviton.
You basically project out the longitudinal.
Yes, yes.
So that's the Feynman gauge.
Okay. Okay, yeah, I hadn't noticed that. If that's true, then maybe you should substitute Feynman where you see dynamical scale. So, having conquered the coupling of the graviton to the active scalar mode, let's move on to look at some of their superpartners. Let's look at all the Fermi fields that we have left in the SO3 invariant subsector of his theory. One thing I didn't really talk about in any detail, because it's sort of technical and not that interesting, is that the Fermi fields in five dimensions are so-called symplectic Majorana spinners. I've assembled pairs of symplectic Majorana spinners into a single field, which you can think of as a complex field, if you like. Just makes the equations a lot tidier. And in that particular notation, these are the equations we find for the various scalar fields. Now, when Fermi fields, excuse me, when the scalar in the background, M, is not varying with the radial coordinate, this prime is the derivative with respect to the radial coordinate, then these terms vanish, and all you have here is essentially a gravitino with a mass term, a spin-a-half field with a mass term, and another spin-a-half field with a mass term. But turning on this background couples one of the spin-a-half fields to the gravitino in this nice way. I've written here what this mass is in terms of background. And what's particularly striking about this system is, despite the fact that these equations had their origin in five-dimensionally covariant Lagrangian, that you end up with these sort of four-dimensional projectors. Gamma r is the gamma 5, if you like, of the r-coordinate, of the fifth dimension. And how this happens is that, well, in each of these equations you have two terms, one with the 1 and one with the I gamma r. The one that does include the gamma r, m prime gamma r here, came originally from a terminal Lagrangian involving this complicated tensor P mu ABCD, which you can think of as something like the derivative of the scalar. And then it reduced to this because M only varies in the fifth dimension. So
in
this just.
Terms, is that the five-form field strength?
This?
Yeah.
This is the kinetic term for all the scalars. Oh, I'm sorry. Mu is a five-dimensional space-time index. A, B, C, D are indices in the scalar space.
Okay, so this corresponds
to sort of the derivative. The kinetic term for the scalar is P squared, essentially. And it contains all the scalars, those that lift to three-form field strength, those that lift to metric, those that are, you know, the dilaton. They're all in here. So half of the projector comes from this origin that includes the space-time derivative, but then the other half actually comes from the fact that there is an ABCD. These are, again, indices in scalar space, a tensor depending on the various scalar fields, which in this case reduces to this cinch. So what you have is M prime gamma R, and you have this cinch of 2M over root 3. But then what you find out is that the supersymmetry condition forces these two to be proportional one to the other. So something that involved an explicit derivative in the fifth dimension is related to something that has no derivatives by the supersymmetry equations. And that allows you to pull out the common factor of M prime, or of cinch, and be left with, in one case, something with no five-dimensional space-time indices, and in the other case, something that does have a five-dimensional space-time index. So it sort of cleverly arranges for four-dimensional structures to emerge. The chirality projectors are also very important for the solving of these equations. For example, to solve this simpler uncoupled spin and half equation, one projects it into two equations, one of each chirality, and then puts them back together to get a second order equation involving only one chirality. For example, the positive projection of this eta spinner obeys this differential equation, where the potential is some complicated function, but all of these are just properties of the background, the scale factor of the metric, and the variation of the scalar. And one can solve that equation. Hopefully it should come as no surprise that the solution is hypergeometric. There it is. Now for the other system, the Gravitino coupling to its partner, one again can make it simpler by gauge fixing the supersymmetry transformations that one has. Now, unfortunately, the simplest things that one might try to do are not possible. For example, one thing one might try to do is to gauge away entirely the coupling of the Gravitino to the spin a half field, or the coupling of the spin a half field to the Gravitino, and just get something that is uncoupled. But it turns out not to be possible, because the supersymmetry transformations are chiral as well. So for example, one can't do an analog of the AFT, Auto-Tunov, Frolov, and Thiessen gauge in the graviton sector, which is to set the lower spin mode to zero. That turns out to be impossible because the supersymmetry variations are chiral, and it turns out that the positive chirality projection is supersymmetry invariant. So what we ended up doing was instead to gauge away the gamma trace of the Gravitino. So this is something like the dynamical scalar gauge in that the dynamics ends up being in the lower spin field. And one can then use the spin a half equation and the Gravitino equations after a lot of work putting things together to get an uncoupled equation for one projection of the spin a half field. One can solve for that, and then all the other modes that you didn't gauge away are determined algebraically by this one. So the system in the end does admit a solution. I just wanted to remark also that there's a Bianchi identity in this coupled system. So it usually happens that when you have a local symmetry, that one or more of the equations of motion will not be independent of the others, but will just be, in a sense, the supersymmetry transformation of the others. And it turns out that the chiral projection of the spin a half equation follows from the Gravitino equation using supersymmetry. So the system is really fully chiral. Supersymmetry basically translated to being a chiral system. And we think it's likely to be generic to all RG flow backgrounds that do have at least n equals 1 supersymmetry. Questions at this point? So, let's see. Now I want to talk a little bit about the vector scalar sector, but maybe not in all of its gory detail, because when you see G22 mod SU2 cross SU2, you know it can get gory. So the scalars parameterize this coset, and it is of the form of a maximally non-compact simple group modded out by its maximal compact subgroup. And for cosets of that form, there exists a so-called solvable parameterization, where one can construct a group element G. You choose the Cartan subalgebra to be the non-compact generator, so we choose M and sigma to be those. And then there's a prescription for taking only the positive roots of this group in the numerator and fluctuations proportional to those. The details aren't really important, but the point is you end up with G as a solvable group that actually generates the manifold that you're interested in. The fact that it's solvable means that after repeated iterations, it eventually vanishes. So that means that the potential, in fact, truncates after sixth order. So it's still an amazing pain, but it doesn't go to infinite order in the fluctuations, which generically it might. It only goes to sixth. So I won't actually write that out, but of the eight scalars that we have left, here they are. There's the active scalar, the sigma scalar, and then the other six fluctuations correspond to these modes here, involving the roots of the algebra. And so it turns out, we've already discussed how the active scalar couples to the graviton, it will turn out that this scalar, which in a sense is its imaginary partner, will couple to the gravifoton field, which we'll talk about shortly. These two, which are also a complex field together, turn out to be free, like they have a very simple solution, which I write down here. And then these other guys will mix in pairs. I guess that's all I need to say here. So we have the eight scalars. We've already talked about how the fluctuation of the active scalar couples to the graviton. Let's talk about the gravifoton and the phase. So there's a field redefinition that turns T10 into this thing we call beta, which is effectively the phase of the active scalar. And it turns out that when you calculate the Lagrangian of this guy, that this is the gravifoton field, which we've talked about before. Here it is with its mass term, but then there's also terms here. Oh, excuse me, this should be squared here. There's also terms that couple it to the divergence of this beta field. So in particular, the kinetic terms for beta we've put in here. And what you see is that you can define a so-called Stuckelberg field, which is the sum of both of these contributions. And then in the kinetic term, the kinetic term for the Stuckelberg field is exactly the same as the kinetic term for the original gravifoton, precisely because this modification looks like a gauge transformation. So one can actually solve just for this field. In a sense, all we've done here is note that the gravifoton is Higgsed by the phase of the active scalar. We already, in fact, solved for the transverse modes. Those were written in terms of the auxiliary scalar F. We can solve for the other modes like this. We get another hypergeometric equation. So here we have a nice parallel, which is that just as the graviton mixed with, in a sense, the modulus of the active scalar, the phase of the active scalar gave mass to the gravifoton. Previous transparency. Okay.
Because we divide by SU2 plus SU2.
So SU2 cross SU2 is the maximal compact subgroup of G22.
H1 and H2 are non-compact.
H1 and H2 are non-compact. That's right. So in a sense, G22 is made up of compact and non-compact generators. This tells me that I want to get...
This SU2 just removes the exponential?
No, the SU2 just means that all the compact generators in here we ignore because we've divided out by them, so we're only left with non-compact generators. These and these. And all this is saying is that one can write this group element in terms of the non-compact generators just by knowing the roots of the algebra, which doesn't even know about whether it's compact or well.
Yes.
So the final scalars, I won't really talk about these in any detail because it's the technical part overwhelms the interesting part. But the other four scalars mix in pairs. If one just tried to solve them mindlessly, you'd get fourth order differential equations, which is sort of ugly. But you can use supersymmetry as a guiding light to tip you off to field redefinitions, under which it turns out that the equations that you have cleanly separate into equations for different modes. And one ends up with a complex scalar rho and a complex scalar tela, which are linear combinations of these guys. And you can solve their differential equations and find out that one of them is dual to a delta equals 2 operator, one dual to a delta equals 4 operator, so that's the dilaton. And one interesting thing is that the dilaton in this parameterization is only asymptotically massless. Its mass vanishes on the boundary, but in the bulk, it's non-zero. So we've now solved for the entire set of SO3 singlet fields in this background. So let me put on a table to remind us of what we've done in this background. So here are the various gravity multiplets that we've solved for. Here are the field theory multiplets. The first thing we did was use the auxiliary scalar F to solve for all of these guys, which are dual to these modes in the supercurrent multiplet. In the active hypermultiplet we solved for, these are the actual modes in that started out life in the hypermultiplet, but of course they mix with modes of the gravity multiplet that we've written in red. It's sort of interesting that the graviton field, the five-dimensional graviton field and its partners start out in five dimensions. You know, you have a graviton. By the time you've broken this down to a background that only has four-dimensional Poincaré invariants and n equals 1 supersymmetry, you find that some of the modes of the graviton field aren't even in the same multiplet as the graviton. They're in the same multiplet as these modes in the active hypermultiplet, which is sort of exotic, I think, but sort of neat. And we also, this rho field, which we just solved for, did not have any relation to the gravity multiplet, and that's good because it is dual in field theory to the bottom component of the anomaly multiplet, which although it is some operator, it has no relation to modes of the supercurrent. And we also solved for the dilaton hypermultiplet, all the easy things that we did first ended up being in here. Questions at this point? So with a couple minutes remaining, I know I advertised the anatomy of two holographic renormalization group flows, and that was really Gray's anatomy for one. Yeah.
Sorry, before you move on to the second, so you've got this explicit solution now. Is there a further check you can do now by, I thought you were going to compare some two-point function in this field theory and in the supergravity or something. Is there a comparison one can make?
No.
No.
I mean, we did not calculate the two-point functions in the field theory. As I alluded to at the beginning, the interpretation of this particular flow in terms of field theory is not even entirely known.
I think we know what it is, but the question is, is this something you can calculate on the field theory side? With only n equals 1 supersymmetry, you're not really likely to... It's not like the n equals 4 case where you're really likely to find something that you can affect it, is it?
You mean that if you did, is that there's nothing to calculate, or that if you did calculate it, it wouldn't look anything like this?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there wouldn't be a strong non-renormalization theorem that would connect something that you calculated in free field theory to one of these guys. So, yeah.
So is the explicit form, let's see, I'm just figuring, I mean, what's the lesson now to try? I mean, so you have all these explicit solutions in terms of hypergeometric functions.
Right.
But is the lesson here how things grouped up, or is the lesson, I mean, is there something
That is certainly one of the lessons. I think how things group up is a nice lesson. I'm going to talk about it even more after I talk about the second flow, because that allows me to contrast it. Besides that, I think the stronger lessons are more about the structure of the holographic duality, more than specific answers about this one field theory. How conformal symmetry is manifested in both sides. There's also a lesson which I didn't really talk about, though I could have, about the dilaton, which is that often when people try to calculate what gets called the glueball spectrum in some holographic dual that they hope is dual to Yang-Mills theory or some supersymmetric generalization of it, they just take a free scalar, go ahead and calculate the spectrum of the free scalar, and say, okay, that's the dilaton, because after all, the dilaton is free. But what we learned here is that actually the mode that's free is this auxiliary scalar F, which tells you about the TT graviton. But the dilaton, the thing which asymptotically was massless of the scalar sector and coupled to trace F squared, actually is not massless at all. It's sort of complicated. So this is another lesson that one has to be careful what one identifies on the field theory side with what's on the gravity side.
Is it possible that as you do reduction to 5 dimensions, that the 10 dimensional dilaton gets mixed with some scalars? And then, so what you said is related to 5 dimensional dilaton, right?
Right.
But that is probably not necessarily the 10 dimensional.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is also a good point.
Right, which is more likely what is happening as a coupling.
I mean, this certainly lifts to some solution, some linearized solution in 10 dimensions, which asymptotically looks like the dilaton. But what it is exactly is a good open question.
When you say that the people calculate free dilaton, is there any paper you mean in particular?
No. Asking me to name names, I don't name names. All right, so the discussion of the Coulomb branch flow is much, much briefer. It's only take a couple of minutes. So just to point out what the flow actually is, it corresponds, the 10-dimensional lift is a uniform disk of D3 brains, so it gives expectation values to various operators in the field theory. There's a single active scalar in the 20 prime representation that is turned on. It breaks the original SO6 down to SO4 cross SO2. It preserves all 16 regular supercharges. And people have already calculated a few two-point functions and found, in fact, that there is a continuous spectrum over a mass gap. And we are not going to find any deviations from this for any of these other guys that we look at. So the spectrum that we calculate is really not interesting at all. In fact, one could say that the large supersymmetry constrains all these spectra to be exactly the same. So what's interesting here is not the result for the spectrum, but instead the structure of the equations and how the multiplets work. So the parts that are a lot like what we've already discussed will be telegraphic. We use the Lagrangian for n equals 4 supergravity in 5 dimensions to actually calculate our equations of motion. That's more of a technical detail, I guess. Now, the graviton and active scalar sector looks exactly the same. It's still determined in terms of this auxiliary scalar, because this is a completely universal set of equations that come just from having a scalar coupled to gravity and an Einstein-Hilbert term in the canonical way. So one can solve this in the same sort of fashion that we discussed. Now, the Gravitino spin a half system, it turns out, has the exact same chiral structure, exactly the same as the GPPZ case that we already discussed. So this is presumably a consequence of the fact that you've preserved n equals 1 supersymmetry. These equations are just the supersymmetric partners of the universal graviton equations. The graviphoton, though, is what's more interesting. Here it has to differ from the GPPZ case, because unlike in that case, the U1R that sits in a multiplet with the graviton is preserved, not broken. So it can't develop a mass. So how does this work? Well, it's actually trivial to calculate not just the U1R that sits in some particular n equals 1 subgroup of the preserved supersymmetry, but all the unbroken vectors, there's SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 of them. Since they're unbroken, they don't have mass terms, but it turns out, as I was alluding to before, there are non-trivial kinetic terms. And what one can do is make a field redefinition to get rid of the extra contribution that comes from this term in the equation of motion, and that generates for you an effective mass. Now, this effective mass is something that, if you look at it, it's really very ugly. And for generic values, for generic functions, phi, which is the scalar in the background, and the scale factor A, this doesn't need to simplify at all. But in fact, in the Coulomb branch case, not in the other case that we discussed before, but in this case, there's an identity that relates two of these terms to the third, like this. So it all collapses into one term. And it turns out that for the values of this constant here that you get for the SU2 and the U1 vectors, and only those constants, that this reduces exactly to the same universal gravifoton mass that we found before for the honestly massive field in the other flow. And therefore, one can make the same arguments that this gets described by an auxiliary scalar. One might expect that supersymmetry requires, well, okay, before I say that, just let me remark on this, that it's sort of nice, and I thought rather non-trivial, that these kinetic terms conspired precisely to reproduce the same kind of mass term that you get explicitly in the other case. There's been some nice work since then by Brandt, Huber, and Svetsos, who showed that for more general Coulomb branch flows, in fact, the broken and the unbroken vectors all have the same spectrum as the graviton, which again, one can ascribe to the large supersymmetry. So the final thing I wanted to say was just to relate this to field theory a little bit and talk about the role of the multiplet in which the active scalar sits in the gravity side. As I mentioned before, only for active scalars sitting in vector multiplets, or actually tensor multiplets, which are very similar, only in those cases can non-trivial kinetic terms for the vector fields even develop. And this allows you, I mean, as I was saying in the previous transparency, this gives you, in a sense, an equivalent Higgs mechanism without an actual Higgs mechanism. You get the same equation of motion for the modes, but you still only have the number of modes that you had for a massless vector field, because it didn't actually have any scalar to eat. And in fact, one realizes, or one looks at the structure of the vector and tensor multiplets, that each of these multiplets only has one real scalar in it in the first place. So if the one real scalar in a vector multiplet is the active scalar, then there is no other scalar field for the gravifoton to come along and mix with and develop a mass. So in the case of the hypermultiplet, we had a complex scalar, which donated its phase to the gravifoton. But in this case, there's nothing extra for it to have. And one can make that as an argument for why the U1R has to remain unbroken in this case. One final thing about this is that you might say, now wait a minute, when you had an active hypermultiplet, it was very nicely dual to the anomaly multiplet of the field theory. You could match the trace of the stress tensor and its superpartners, etc. Now you've got a vector multiplet. How will that ever match to this field theory quantity, which is a chiral field? Well, it turns out that it's been known for quite some time, though it was new to me, that if the U1R is still preserved, despite the fact that conformal and superconformal invariants have been broken, that the anomaly multiplet is not a chiral multiplet at all, but a linear multiplet. And linear multiplets, in fact, have the same degrees of freedom as vector multiplets. So it actually matches up exactly, this correspondence, that vector multiplets in the five dimensions go with linear anomaly multiplets, while if you have an active hypermultiplet in five dimensions, it will give you a regular chiral multiplet with broken R symmetry. And that's what I've tried to summarize in this table here. So I'm ready to conclude. What have we done today? about. We examined and we solved equations for coupled and uncoupled fluctuations in both the Coulomb branch and the GPPC holographic RG flows. One of the things we did was we obtained solutions for all the SO3 invariant modes of this GPPZ flow and found their glue ball spectra. We demonstrated how, quite in general, the auxiliary scalar F gives you the physical modes of a gravity multiplet, and the graviphoton in that gravity multiplet has a universal effective mass, given in this way in terms of the metric scale factor, which in one case is induced by non-trivial vector kinetic terms. And we showed that the field theory anomaly multiplet and the active bulk multiplet are dual one to the other. In one case, you have a chiral, and in the other case, a linear field theory multiplet corresponding to a hyper or vector multiplet. And that's entirely determined by whether the R symmetry is broken or not. So I think this all is a nice sort of nice structure to see how the bulk theory reproduces effects of the dual field theory. And I'll stop there. Questions.
I guess trying to do something in the fully 10-dimensional solution is quite prohibitive, right? All of this mode analysis.
It would be painful, certainly. I mean, in these particular 5-dimensional cases, these solutions would lift to something in 10 dimensions,
right,
though I don't know exactly what that looks like. To do these sorts of computations in 10 dimensions, I thought about it for a while. It would be nice. I don't think it's impossible, but it would be very painful.
Any other questions? Random questions?